the obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
So that's President Trump talking about his big, beautiful spending bill. Robert Hogan joins us now, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU, to talk about it. How are you doing, Dr. Hogan?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about, I saw a CBS report last night where the reporter was directly quoting President Trump as saying, "Don't F with Medicare," telling the Republicans. But yet, Steve Scalise was on social media saying that Medicaid was for people, not for only people that were disabled, not able-bodied people that could work, et cetera. And I'm paraphrasing Steve Scalise there. I guess The question is, are they all on the same page here when what's in this big, beautiful bill? And I guess the question that precedes that is, does anybody really know what's in this big, beautiful bill?
Yeah, it's still a little unclear. It's my understanding the Rules Committee is still meeting right now. They met starting at 1 o'clock last night to hammer out the rules in the House, and what that means is it really sets the parameters of the debate, what is going to be in the bill ultimately, and whether it can be amended and that sort of thing. So they're still trying to decide what's going to be in the bill. Trump went to Capitol Hill yesterday. It's not certain whether or not he did any good, or he may have done some harm. He did make it clear, though, that he wanted Republicans online, that everybody needed to vote for it. It was a test of whether or not you were, I think at one point he said something like, if you're a real Republican, you're going to vote for this. It is something he is putting his political capital on. Mike Johnson's political life is on the line as well, whether or not he can deliver. It's a huge balancing act for Republicans. Remember, this is a piece of a reconciliation process. They only need to pass it with a majority, and that doesn't sound like very much given the fact that the Republicans hold a majority in the House of Representatives, but they can only stand to lose 3 votes. And it's a balancing act for Republicans. All the Democrats are going to vote against it in the House, and so they have to all be on board with it. But the balancing act, on one side, you've got a lot of the hardline members of the Freedom Caucus, conservatives, who want to use this opportunity that the Republicans control the federal government. They want to see real structural changes that make long-term changes into social programs. They want to cut these things even more. On the other side of the Republican caucus, you have a lot of the Republicans that are in swing districts in the blue states who are saying, look, you know, don't cut too much. If you cut too much into Medicaid, you're going to harm my chances of winning reelection. It's going to make it difficult for Republicans to retain control of the House of Representatives in the 2026 election. So Johnson is really he's got a major balancing act to play here. And if you will recall, when Biden was the president Democrats, you know, still had a lot of control in both chambers, Johnson was able to get things done in the House, but only because Democrats at the very last minute got a lot of concessions and then supported what he passed. He was never really able to pass anything of consequence budget-wise that didn't get the support of Democrats. So this is, you know, Mike Johnson's reputation here is on the line. This is the big game for him. If he can deliver on this, his capital goes up greatly. The price of his stock goes up greatly, and we'll have to see. And Republicans win. If they get it passed, they got to make certain that a majority of the Senate, the 53 members of the Republican coalition in the Senate, whether or not they agree with it. And if they do, it can be passed with a bare majority in the Senate. You don't have to worry about the filibuster because the process is working under reconciliation. So this could be, you know, the Republicans are on the verge of a considerable win with the president's priorities if they can pass it. But that's the question. Can they pass it? If they can't, then this is a huge win for the Democrats by being able to stop them.
I'm getting some texts from a lot of people here trying to, quote, help me out, saying you're confused. Medicare is different from Medicaid. Whoever's texting this in, y'all, you need to go do some research, because the president was specifically talking about Medicaid, not
Absolutely.
Medicare. And the professor will tell you the difference when we come back. And he'll also explain why the president is concerned politically with Medicaid, not Medicare. So I know what I'm talking about, and the president knows what he's talking about as well. Y'all need to look it up to make sure you know what you're talking about. 620 traffic now, WWL. All right, 624, Tommy Tucker, WWL. To be clear, I said Medicaid because it stuck out with me last night that the president would say don't blink around with Medicaid, because that is a program that's run by the states but funded by the federal government. Explain the difference, if you will, Professor, between Medicare and Medicaid, and why the president would be concerned with Medicaid as it relates to elections, because you're talking about a different constituency. Am I not correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Medicare is a program that started in the mid-1960s that everyone who works pays money into, it is basically insurance for when you retire. When you get to a certain age and retire, then you receive benefits, and it is a health insurance program for people who are old. Medicaid is a program that is means-based. It's funded by the federal government and the state governments, and it's based upon your income levels. And it also, some of it goes to disabled people. Medicaid is what is on is being considered for cuts, because they're thinking about cutting whatever the bill happens to be. It's going to be a substantial amount, maybe $1.5 trillion over the next decade. And a lot of people are concerned about this because these are real cuts to people who are, for example, in nursing homes. About 60% or so of people in nursing homes nationwide are able to be in nursing homes because they receive Medicaid. In Louisiana, about 75% of people in nursing homes receive Medicaid based on their income. So this has the potential to have major cuts for that are real, and that can affect a lot of people. And that is why a lot of members of Congress are concerned about this, even ones that are in very red parts of the country. You think about very rural parts of the states like Louisiana. You've got a lot of people who are that rely on Medicaid, especially when they get old and they go into nursing homes. They don't want, the members of Congress don't want to are fearful of the backlash that might have and how it could affect them electorally. So these are real big issues that we're confronting. Of course, there are a lot of people who argue that the Medicaid issue is something that we need to think about and talk about and maybe reconsider. And some members of Congress, some of the members of the Freedom Caucus, want very deep cuts and structural changes in those programs. So that's the balancing act that Mike Johnson, Speaker Johnson, is having to balance right now to keep his caucus together.
Representative Johnson from Louisiana, a lot of people, for example, in Julia Letlow's district, about a third of them in her district, and she was elected by a wide margin, are enrolled mm-hmm. in Medicaid.
Absolutely.
So the Republicans are walking a fine line here, and I'm just wondering about Mike Johnson trying to wrangle his coalition. He's from a poor state, but maybe yep. the people that he's trying to wrangle are not from a poor state, so it goes back to all elections being local, and I just think this Medicaid part of it is a big thing, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely huge, and I think it's a lot of the success of this, I think, is going to come down to this issue. And while a lot of people are saying, and a lot of Democrats who are just standing by, watching to see what the Republicans are doing, are thinking to themselves, the Republicans are going to have a very hard time getting something like this passed. And if they do, the Democrats are going to pounce. You can see the commercials now going into 2026. Look, Republicans cut social programs, cut Medicaid by a certain amount, and you're seeing the consequences of it. The elections are always in the background of American politics, especially in the House of Representatives, where you have them every 2 years. And this is something that is certainly being weighed in the balance.
So the president gets this. He's trying to get the other Republicans to get this. That's up to Mike Johnson to get them to get this, or is that up to the president to get him to get this? Because ultimately, the president's not going to take blame for it.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell yesterday with what he said about Medicaid. You know, he does not want to get blamed for it. But, I mean, ultimately, it's his fellow partisans who are having to walk the line on this one. And it sounds to me like he's wanting to not so much give support or cover to them as he is trying to tell them, hey, you know what you need to do for me. Go out there and do it.
Because if he loses the House, he's got trouble for the next 2 years.
Exactly. And that has been the pattern, I might point out, in the last several decades in the United States, as you see, you know, a president getting elected and bringing the House of Representatives with him. Even though the coattails have been really short in recent years. And he has the first 2 years to get done what he needs to get done. And then the House of Representatives changes to the other party, and it makes it, you know, exceedingly difficult then to get things done. So, I mean, the Republicans have had difficulty getting things passed even when they have a majority, but it has been a bare majority. It would be even more difficult if they were in the minority.
It's amazing. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. It's amazing some of the texts I'm getting, Trump defenders saying, you're obsessed with Medicaid. I'm not obsessed with anything. I'm telling you what your boy, President Trump, said. I'm just repeating what he said. So like it or not, don't blame me. I'm just telling you what President Trump himself told the Republicans, which is, don't blank with Medicaid. So you can deal with that however you like. 6:30, we'll take a break. Come back. WWL. 6:43, 17 before 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Hot, humid today. Maybe a spritz on a windshield here or there. I had a couple of sprinkles on the way in. Legislative session continues. Libby Sonnier joins us now, Executive Director for Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. Talk about early education, where funding stands for that, etc. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Let's talk about what happened, where it stands now, and then we'll talk about the importance of this. Because one thing, and I said this earlier, that I continue to scratch my head over is, I talk to you a lot. We talk about the importance of early childhood education. We talk about reading at grade level. We talk about the state being poor. We talk about raising educational standards. But yet, inevitably, we talk about funding for this being cut, and I don't understand this at all. But tell me where we stand right now.
So where we stand right now is the governor and his executive budget had maintained the level of funding in his budget, about $78 million. Then the budget went through House Bill 1, which is the budget bill, went to House Appropriations, and we came out of House Appropriations with no cut. So we maintained the $78 million. And then last week, the budget went to the floor of the House and was passed with no cuts to early childhood education. So we're in a good spot right now. It's now, the budget is now walking over to the Senate. The Revenue Estimating Committee meets today, and it seems like they'll recognize some potential new revenue in the state, and then we'll see where the budget lands once they do that.
So let's talk about what this looks like when we talk about funding for childhood education. That's a nice phrase, but for people that don't understand, what does it mean?
Sure. So funding for early childhood education means creating access for families to be able to go to school and work and have some support, especially for our families that are below 200% the federal poverty level. And so when families have access to quality early childhood education, that means businesses have access to reliable workers that they know that can be there on time. And it's not just about families being able to go to school and work, which is ultimately incredibly important for our economy, but it's also really important because it allows our young children to be kindergarten ready. And if we've all seen the gains Louisiana has made in K-12 education. And Dr. Brumley was with us yesterday at the early ed day at the Capitol, and he said, you know, he basically couldn't imagine that, you know, children having access to quality early childhood education hasn't had a play into Louisiana's educational gains.
Does the Gator program have anything to do with this, the governor's Gator program, in terms of funding? Is early childhood education competing with that for funding, or is it two separate things?
I mean, I think fundamentally all education is a continuum, and if one group of education people get money, then you kind of have to jockey around. We don't see this competition actually because we want to make sure that children have access and families have access to the educational setting that they want, but it does limit the resources that we have in the state.
So, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, it seemed like a yes, Libby. It seemed like you were dancing around it, and I know you got the political things to take care of, and you the end goal is to get early childhood education funded, but I guess, and I don't mean to put you in a tough political spot here, but if you were to compare and contrast, if it's either or, I would think early childhood education takes precedent over the Gator program. I don't want to put you in that position, but it would seem to me that it does, because if you don't have kids, if you don't, let me rephrase the question, Your Honor. Let me phrase it this way. Talk about, if you will, Libby Sonnier, the importance of getting kids early and teaching them the fundamentals and then having them, say, reading by third grade level when, for example, they might take advantage of the Gator program. Let me phrase it that way.
So fundamentally, we know that 90% of brain development happens by age five. And so all those good educational opportunities that really set children up to be successful in the K-12 space happen in early childhood. So you're learning phonemic and phonological awareness, which are sounds and speech of language, so you can be ready to read, learning how to get along with your friends, learning how to follow directions, having early literacy and math skills. All that happens prior to getting into kindergarten. And so we have, you know, approximately 70% of kindergartners are entering into kindergarten not quite ready to learn. Imagine if we had more access to quality early childhood education. We have over 100,000 children birth through age four that are in need that don't have access to quality early childhood education.
So as you say this, I'm thinking of the old example of, you know, whether you're learning math or reading or anything else, they always tell you, you got to have a foundation, right? You got to have, if you're building a house, you got to have a firm foundation no matter what. Because if you build anything on a shaky foundation, then it's going to collapse.
Yes.
Is that exactly what
we're saying?
Right. And it's more expensive. Is that, and you have to deal with the offshoots of things collapsing and any damage to people or anything else in rebuilding. So is that exactly what we're talking about here when it comes to early childhood education, a proper foundation?
It really is. It is a proper foundation. And so we know that children that have access to quality early childhood education in these first 5 years of life tend not to need remedial education, need special education. They're more likely to graduate from high school. Once they graduate from high school, they're more likely to go towards post-secondary education. And then from longitudinal research, we know that children that receive that high-quality early childhood education in the first 5 years of life, they're doing better in their midlife. You know, they have better cardiometabolic outcomes as well as financial stability and health outcomes. Like, it is the foundation for all other foundations for learning and, quite frankly, for health, too.
So to be clear, and we're going to pick it up here when we come back, somebody texted in and said, you just said there were no cuts. There's no cuts as it came out of the House. It's still got to get through the Senate, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Just to be clear, everybody understands what's going on here. They hear what they want to hear and they think what they want to think. But as it stands now, there are no cuts. Originally, $9 million was cut. It was put back in the House. Now we got to see.
No, it was not.
It was not.
The $9 million was not put. Well, we're hopeful. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You tell me.
Sorry. I was like, so we're hopeful with the Revenue Estimating Committee meeting today. If they recognize more revenue, that we're able to get the $9 million back that was reduced from last legislative session.
So it was reduced by $9 million. You're dependent on the Revenue Estimating Committee to say the money's going to be there to put it back. Accurate?
Accurate, okay. But let me be clear that the governor and the House maintained what's currently in this fiscal year's budget for next fiscal year's budget. So now what we're asking is if there's new revenue recognized, if we could get the $9 million back that we lost last year.
All right. We'll pick it up when we come back. And for those of you listening and texting in, I would suggest, and I'm not trying to be petty here or anything, but instead of trying to correct me, maybe you just listen to what we're talking about here and get the facts straight, and then you can text in. Just saying. 651-9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with our friend Libby Sonnier, Dr. Libby Sonnier, Executive Director of the Louisiana Policy Institute for Children, talking about the importance of early childhood education. Libby, earlier I was saying you wouldn't build a house with a bad foundation, so you could, you know, cut on the cheap out on the foundation so you could put an elaborate bathroom in because the whole thing's going to collapse, right? So I'm getting some texts from some people here of the get out of my yard ilk of the when I walked to school the snow was 10 feet deep ilk, that kind of thing. talking about that this is at the only reason this is necessary is because of negligence of parents. Talk about that if you will, please.
Oh wow, that's an interesting comment. You know what we know from our data.
I get a lot of interesting comments, Libby, believe me. I get a lot of interesting comments.
Well, I'm going to lean into the data and say that we know that 2/3 of Louisiana children have all available parents in the workforce. And so, and we know that parents have to work to be able to take care of their children. So it's not negligence. It's that parents need access to quality early childhood education where they know their children are learning and are safe so that they can be productive citizens and be part of our economy. We know that, you know, over 60% of our mamas go back to work within the first year of their child's life, because they have to. And so we need to make sure that wherever children are, that they're in quality, safe settings where they're learning and they're being cared for by credentialed people. And that's what happens when children have access to quality early childhood education.
Look, I know you can't speak to the people that escaped from Orleans Parish Prison, that you have no idea anything about these people. But looking to the stats and the facts, when it comes to, I find it hard to believe that you go from being an ideal student to being a murderer and escaping from a prison. So I got to believe that when it comes to societal investment, the best thing we can do is get people on the right educational track to keep them out of trouble. Do the stats bear that out?
The research does bear that out. We know for children that really do have this access to quality early childhood education, they have reduced rates of being in the juvenile system and the court system. And we also know that they have better health outcomes and they're finishing school and doing better in life. And so it is a strong, healthy foundation. Like you said earlier, if you have a faulty foundation, it's really so much more expensive when you don't do it right the first time. And what we're trying to do right now is that children only have one chance at a childhood. Let's make sure we're putting them on the right path to have educational outcomes so that they can thrive.
Libby, you convinced me. You know, you got an open forum here whenever you want. Come on back. We'd love to stay in touch with you and keep track of what's going on here. Libby Sonnier with the Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. 7:15. I had been calling it the Great Escape. I think I'm going to start calling it the Not So Great Escape that happened on Friday. And you know, I often quote movie and TV shows. Remember Better Call Saul, the first episode where they got these kids accused of this ridiculous crime and the guy gives his impassioned defense? Then all the prosecutor does is quietly stand up and show the videotape. And that's what I'm reminded of with this jailbreak, because you can talk about too many people in a prison. You can talk about this. You can talk about that. But the videotape doesn't lie. They were captioned on videotape during doing this. And Mike Pearlstein joins us now, WWL-TV investigative reporter. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. I was watching you on Friday, you and Katie Moore, and just the, I guess, the shock in your face was palpable, because you knew what was involved for this to happen, right?
Well, we kept finding out new information.
But you know the construction,
by the half an
you know
hour.
The construction of the prison. You know that this doesn't. This is not
right.
Just a one off. This doesn't just happen spontaneously within 10 minutes.
Oh
is what
no,
I'm saying.
No. I've toured that prison, and I've been shown by Sheriff Hudson herself the deficiencies on those jail doors. That's a real thing, and she was talking about that as early as 2022. And sure enough, it's been used, and there have been issues and problems one inmate at a time. What is so?
Well, let me talk about that.
Let me
ask you about that. With the doors, does that factor into this at all? Because again, you know, if somebody had been monitoring the cameras, they would have seen all of this, right?
Oh, there's no doubt. And it's a long list of breakdowns that contributed to this stunning jailbreak of 10 inmates. You can look for, you know, jail escapes anywhere throughout the country in recent history, and there might be an inmate here or two there, but not 10. This is just one of those, and that's part of the reaction, not just by me and the rest of the media, but the, you know, the general public and all city and state officials all the way up to the governor's office. This just doesn't happen. And I've said it on your show before that sometimes you get a news story that it just seems like it can only happen in New Orleans.
That's what I mean by looking at your face on Friday. What you just said, that's exactly what I'm trying to say.
Well, there's always a bizarre twist and drama, you know, above the hole that they carved, you know, where the toilet was in that cell. You know, too easy, LOL. That's just such a New Orleans twist to this thing. And now we have so many other spinoff stories, obviously with Sheriff Hudson up for re-election. She's now suspended her campaign. This has political layers to it. You have the governor and the attorney general, Liz Murrell, weighing in heavily. First, to help capture the inmates who are still on the loose, to investigate the jail. And, you know, who knows where this is going to end up? We keep hearing new revelations and blockbuster announcements, and hopefully we'll be hearing about more captures of the five remaining inmates.
Somebody texted in, and I think it's funny because, in a way, funny, not really, but I talked about, you know, all of the... That, like you're talking about, Mike, outlining the failures and this upon that upon that upon that. And they texted and said, yet the guy that turned the water off is the one that gets arrested. He's the least of this, right? I mean, when it comes, I'm not defending him at all. Believe me, I'm not. But when it comes to chain of responsibility and things that had to happen for this to occur, the guy that turned the water off is the least of this, I would think. Accurate?
Well, everyone seemed to play their role, and according to his account, contained in his affidavit for his arrest on, you know, malfeasance and 10 counts of aiding escape, was that he did this at the threat of being shanked, that he was threatened by the inmates, basically, help us turn that water off or else. And I can actually tell you, having covered that jail and the issues with contraband, help from guards. The guards had been arrested previously for, you know, bringing in everything from cell phones to drugs. To have threats from inmates be at the root of assisting the inmates is not uncommon.
But I can see the threat. And, Mike, I can see the threat if you're being held hostage. But if somebody says, if you come back to work tomorrow, I'm going to shank you if you don't do this, well, don't go back to work tomorrow and report it, right? Am I missing something or not?
You would look, obviously, that's why he's been arrested and being held on a very high bail, because obviously the judgment there was poor. He certainly would have options. But boy, when you are working on a daily basis around some of the, you know, most violent offenders in this city, and that is one of the things, one of the many things that makes this case so remarkable. That if you look at the 10 inmates, five now captured, and their rap sheets, this is really, you could just say this is among the worst of the worst. You know, somebody like Derek Groves, who's still at large, he's been involved in four killings. He's been convicted on two counts.
The obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a second-degree murder, and then he later pled guilty to two counts of manslaughter. So this is a person who has, but in the eyes of the court, killed four people.
We got to take a break, and Mike. I'm going to pick it up here when we come back. Real quick, do you know how long the water was supposed to have been turned off for?
They have not revealed that, but, you know, understand, there's an eight-hour window from when these guys first got out before anyone knew anything about it. So,
I guess what I'm saying is
anything could happen.
It would
I don't know, if you're not going to notice the video, if you're not going to notice his Marlon Gusman told his alarms with doors being propped open and everything else, I find it hard to believe that the water would have been the turning point in any of this anyway. But we'll pick it up with Mike Pearlstein. We come back. 722 traffic now, WWL. And I'm not defending this guy, believe me, I'm not. It is 727. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mike Pearlstein, our friend, WWL Louisiana investigative reporter, awarded print journalist, a very talented guy, an investigative reporter, bar none. Mike, you're familiar with the jail. You've been looking at this for a long time. I just want to pick your brain now with, where do you think this goes next?
Well, let's hope that it goes first with announcements of some more arrests. Mm-hmm. It cannot be understated overstated that the people who are on the loose are considered very dangerous. And this is a, you know, five-alarm fire until the rest of those inmates are captured. The investigations, both internally and by the state, are going to proceed, I imagine, in an expedited manner. We're going to learn a lot more about how this went down. So what you've seen with the video of first the inmates jostling the jail cell door, showing that vulnerability that those doors can be rigged to, you know, be cracked open, somehow punching a hole in the wall from behind the wall of that cell, that has to be answered. Who got back there behind a wall? That is not something that's going to be accessible to inmates. And when you see how, you know, that toilet fixture was removed and heavy rebar sliced through, which what jail officials called a clean cut, which could only be done by a tool, probably an electric tool. So the full story of how this happened, it's going to come out. There's a lot of eyes on this, and we're going to hear some remarkable stuff. And I know it's a cliche to say this, but in New Orleans, we run into these stories so frequently, you just couldn't possibly make this up. The facts are, you know, too crazy, and that's why it's national and now international news.
You've been in the jail. I never have, and I don't plan on going, but for this to happen, what you're describing there, and I was talking to Marlon Gusman about this yesterday, if your neighbor is sanding a piece of furniture, you hear it, right? So this is inside of a building. This had to have made a tremendous amount of noise, and I would think almost everybody in a building was aware of what was going on. Am I missing something here or not?
Well, and that's points out a big and open question. We just don't know, because clearly this was not done, you know, even let's say in an hour while some employee took a lunch break and left that whole pod without any eyes on it, allowing these inmates to get out of their cells, go into this other handicapped cell, go through this wall, hole in the wall. It's really apparent that hole in the wall, the removal of the toilet fixture, had to have been done sometime earlier. And of course, you asked the right question. How did that go undetected? Who else might be involved? We've seen the arrest of one employee that very well may not be the last employee. We've had three suspended. We still need to learn the circumstances there. With everyone from the Attorney General's office on down investigating this, we're going to get some answers, and we should really be prepared for, you know, any twist. As remarkable as this whole scenario has been so far, I'm open to, you know, whatever could come out of this. I was able to just pick a story, you know, yesterday that at the time of this escape, there were 81 state inmates ready to be, you know, shipped out to serve their time in state DOC prisons. And that contributed to this problem because they were housed in high security areas so that these inmates who escaped from the first floor, we're not on a second and third or maybe a floor that would have made it harder to escape.
Mike, we got to run. I appreciate your time and your expertise. We'll talk to you again soon. And Marlon Gusman yesterday saying they would make a run every Tuesday to bring prisoners to Angola. So why were they there? I don't know. Right now, time for WWL First News. So that would go to Dave Cohen. 747, 13 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Legislative session continues. Back on April 10th, Will Green issued a statement. The CEO of the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, insurance reform is a top priority for LABI. As it is for citizens across the state, we remain fully committed to advocating for common sense legislation to address this crisis head on by bringing much needed transparency and fairness to Louisiana's legal system. Will Green joins us now, President and CEO of Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. How you doing, Will?
Hey, Tommy. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
How's that working out for you, that statement that you made?
You know, Tommy, we're the session, it's a fiscal session, and normally tax and budget dominate the discussion. But this year, the legislature is moving through and prioritizing a package of bills that we hope will create a system in Louisiana, a civil justice system in Louisiana that encourages a fair, consistent, and transparent civil justice system to help attract insurance carriers back to the market, to help maybe, you know, address some of the outliers that you know, we see in our civil justice system. You know, when we look at states like Georgia and Florida, Tennessee and South Carolina, they are actively looking to address ways in which they are an outlier. We looked at what they have done. We know we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We do know that we are among the highest cost states in the country. And so we're excited, very encouraged about what the legislature is doing this session to address some of the ways in which we're an outlier.
Well, let's talk some of those things that you're about. Some of those things you're excited about, Will, because maybe I'm missing something. But just as a consumer, and I'm not the president and CEO of Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, but I'm doubtful as to whether or not I'm going to see anything change as far as car insurance rates go. Tell me what makes you optimistic.
Well, so, I mean, look, like I said earlier, look, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? I mean, we can look at one of the things like modified comparative fault. We're one of 11 states in the country that have a pure comparative fault standard.
Explain what that is, Will, for people not in the industry, please.
Yeah, so in Louisiana, you can be more at fault than the person that actually, so you can actually be more at fault than the person you're suing, still sue and recover damages. So you can be 75% at fault for the accident, still sue and recover 25% damages. Mm-hmm. In 39 other states, that's not the case. If you're more at fault for the accident, you cannot sue and recover damages. And so Representative Chenevert has a bill to basically put us in line with 39 other states to say that if you're 51% more at fault, are 51% or more at fault for the accident, you cannot sue and recover for damages.
And what is the status of that bill, Will?
That bill has passed out of the House. It's passed out of the Senate Jude Committee, and it is set to be heard in the Senate today. And so we're hopeful. We would encourage all your listeners, call their senators, ask them to support that bill. And so if that bill passes the Senate floor today, it can be concurred with over in the House floor, and it goes to the governor's desk for his signature. And so we think that's a huge win. That is something that Florida passed recently in 2023. And look, if you can Google Florida right now, and you can see that as a result of some of the massive changes that Florida made, and that was one piece of the puzzle that Florida did. Florida has attracted carriers to their state. Insurance carriers have announced either rate decreases or rate stabilizations. And so, look, while we say there's no silver bullet to lowering insurance rates, we know that there are things that we can do to make us more attractive for insurance carriers to come to Louisiana, to do business in Louisiana. And we know that competition is one of the things that helps lower rates. We know that because we can see what other states have done.
What else besides comparative fault? Yesterday, I know, was an important day. Talk about some of the other things that were being debated.
Yeah, so another thing that's passed off of out of Senate committee, and it'll be on the floor today, is medical expense transparency. And so this is something that we've talked about for a long time. It's providing the jury and the judge with the whole picture, right? And so, as you know, Tommy, as well as I do, that when you go to have a medical procedure done, you get a medical bill, right? But what you also know is that medical bill oftentimes is just a sticker price, right? There's a negotiated rate that insurance pays. That rate is much, much lower than the sticker price for that medical bill. And then you have a deductible. And so let's use easy math here. Let's say the medical bill was $100. That negotiated rate oftentimes is about $2. And then your deductible is $1. And so all that insurance is out is $2, and all you're out is $1. So really, the full price of that medical bill is $3. You and I know that. But unfortunately, in Louisiana, the jury and the judge doesn't know that. And so what Senator Reese's legislation would do is it would allow the jury to see that the true cost of the medical bill, the true cost of the damage, if you will, is $3, and allow them the decision to award $3 instead of the sticker price of $100.
You just said sticker price. I want to make that relatable in that it would be the same as I buy a car at the dealership. The sticker price is $50,000. I get it for $40,000. But then I would go to a jury and seek to be reimbursed for the car for $50,000, a full sticker price, when I only paid $40,000. Accurate?
That's right. Okay. That's right. So the jury wouldn't get to see that, well, there's actually manufacturer's rebates of $5,000. Mm-hmm. You negotiated another $5,000 with the dealer, and so you only paid $40,000. Well, imagine if you went to the jury and only showed the jury the manufacturer's sticker price on that. We don't think that's fair. A lot of other states have said that's not fair. And as a result, that is inflating jury awards, and we're all paying for that as payers of insurance in Louisiana.
Thank you, Will. Appreciate your time. The session's got some time to go. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure. Will Green, President and CEO of Louisiana Association of Business and Industry. To be clear, none of this is going to happen quickly, but it's kind of like eating an elephant. You got to start somewhere. 7:54, 6 till 8, traffic now, WWL. It's 8:17. The easiest way to, I guess, reference where the on-ramp is closed, it's if you're heading, and you'd be sitting right in front of the infamous Orleans Justice Center now, whatever you call it, I always mess it up, Orleans Parish Prison, whatever it used to be. You'd be sitting right in front of that, and as you're trying to head to Metairie, if you were to take the exit by the prison that would take you to Airline Drive and then take a shortcut to wherever you're going, Cleary or maybe even Clearview or wherever, and get on the horseshoe, or you can't. Or Airline all the way to Clearview. You can't do that because they got an overturned garbage truck and it's going to be closed for about a month, Scott Boyd with DOTD is saying. So be aware of that. And west and east and all that stuff confuses me because I'm from New Orleans and I'm a West Banker. So anyway, it's heading from Metairie downtown New Orleans to Metairie. If you wanted to take the airline exit and get on Airline Drive, you're not going to be able to do it for about a month until they get that garbage truck situation righted. We've been talking from this morning really about the not so great escape from the Orleans Justice Center and national news last night. CBS led with it, and you know, I'm just sitting there thinking, I feel so bad for New Orleans and Company that worked so bad to promote the city and put the positive parts of it. And then the city looks like a laughing stock with what, you know, is being reported. And it takes something to knock Hamas and Palestine off of the front or the top story, as well as President Trump and the budget and all that. But the sheriff's office managed to do it with the escape and the prisoners that are still at large. I had a big hearing yesterday in the city council. Freddie King joins us now, our friend, New Orleans City Council member, fellow Shaw graduate. How you doing, Freddie?
I'm good, Tommy. How about yourself?
I'm all right. One thing I do take issue with is that a lot of people kind of jumped on this to make whatever political point they wanted. And one incontrovertible thing, and you're a lawyer, that I can't get past is that this is on video, and Liz Murrow, God bless her, talking about reducing the number of inmates in the prison. Well, if the number was only 11, they wouldn't, or 10, they wouldn't have caught what happened here, right? So How do you keep, when it comes to an elected official, when it comes to keeping your eye on the ball and finding responsibility and assigning responsibility, how do you keep the politics out of this? And let's get to what actually happened and what's true and what's not.
That's a great question, Tommy. And I don't look at things from the lens of an elected official. I am first a born and raised proud New Orleanian who looks at things as a citizen, as a father, as a husband who just wants a safe community and reasonable people running the show. So it's that's how I look at it. I just use common sense and something that the DA said on your show, I believe it was Monday, and when you have times of crisis, you can either be someone who finds a solution or you could be someone who adds chaos. And I try to be someone who finds a solution because we have enough with social media, with just media and people running for office and trying to make political points. We have enough people trying to add chaos. So I just try to be that voice of reason and just look at this from a practical standpoint. Again, not as an elected official, but as an everyday person who has a family, who's born in this city, who wants the best for his city, and not to see us the laughing stock of the national news.
You're right, and that's why I talk about facts and keeping the eye on the ball here, because look, Jason Williams was one with us. I'm glad you listened, and he was saying that, you know, the governor took him on Sunday, and that's, I was working out and I heard that and it surprised me, because like, well, that seems an odd direction to go in for the governor, but he did. And then come to find out, talking to Marlon Gussman yesterday, I don't know if you heard that or not, but he said they'd make a run every Tuesday bringing prisoners to Angola. So there was no reason for these people to be at the Orleans Justice Center, let alone on the first floor. So before we start talking about DA's office and everything else, we need to look at who's running the prison and what actually led to this. And also, Freddie, I'll add in, I've been saying this, I don't know if you've been listening or not, this is not like Shawshank Redemption or Clint Eastwood digging at a softened rock with a spoon. This is akin to a construction project that went on for a while that seemingly nobody noticed. Is that accurate?
That's what I've been hearing. Again, I don't have all the facts, but I've been hearing that this is not a Hollywood script. Look, there's a lot of people, not a lot, there are people clearly from the inside who made this possible. I know at least one person has been arrested. I know there's an ongoing investigation. But I think it's important, let's first get all of the facts before we start to the finger point. When you point the finger at someone, you have three more fingers pointing back at you. And I think that was evident with the press conference with the governor. You know, he's talked about the DA, he's talked about other elected officials in the city, but the state has some culpability. They at least one of the inmates, I don't know the exact number, should have been in custody of DOC.
But that's up to the sheriff, is it not, Freddie? Doesn't the sheriff make that call, as I understand, at least what I've been able to uncover?
Again, that can't be the case, Tommy. I don't want to pretend that I'm an expert in this, but it's more than one person. And pointing the finger, now it's not the time for that. Let's find out how this happened. Let's find out who's responsible as far as on the inside, and then we can figure out, hey, how does it not happen again? And what leaders were responsible? So I'm just trying to figure out how did it happen and make sure that these individuals are safe. I mean, not safe. What I mean is the individuals are caught in the family of the victims and the victims of community.
So,
exactly.
So along those lines, how confident are you moving forward? You know, you're talking about keeping the community safe, keeping your family safe. Your district includes the French Quarter. That moving forward, whatever is, you see, because here's the deal. It's like what you're talking about with the press conference, and I made an example of this with a listener before, where it's kind of like, okay, the plane crashed, but you're also noticing that the seatbelt light was out. All right, that's fine. You can go back and later on fix the seatbelt light, but that didn't cause the plane to crash, right? So you can go back and find a lot of things that are wrong. You need to triage to keep planes from crashing moving forward. How confident are you moving forward in the next week, the next month, the next couple of months, that things will be taken care of at the jail where people in New Orleans will be safe?
I'm very confident. One reason is because all eyes are now on the jail. Much like the city for Super Bowl, we made sure that we put our best foot forward because all eyes were on the city. So, you know, the sheriff and her team will be making sure, I would hope, making sure that, look, this has international attention. Let's make sure that nothing like this could possibly happen again. And I mentioned yesterday with another media outlet, Tommy, that we have an election coming up in 5 or so months. Mm-hmm. The public will be able to decide the new leadership of the jail. And that new person, if it's a new person, whoever they decide, would be able to say, this is my vision moving forward. This is how I plan on keeping the jail safe inside and out. So I believe that
but
it's
my
going
point,
to be rectified.
Yeah, my point is before mm-hmm. that, though, in the 5 months leading up to that, somebody's got to get things under control at that jail and make sure that something like this doesn't happen again.
Correct. I believe that's the case. And I just know what I would do. If I have all the attention on me, I'm going to make sure Freddie King will make sure that this cannot happen again. My team will be I'll make it very clear to my team that we need to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And look, the council has pledged to help where we can. I know we have now other sheriff departments pledging to help where they can, whether it's taking inmates and bringing them there. We have now the eyes of the state government to help. So we have help coming in. We have people willing to help to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Thank you, Freddie. Appreciate your time. Freddie King, New Orleans City Councilman, District C, Algiers and a Quarter. Somebody texted in and said, the DOC tells you when and where to bring inmates or when DOC will pick them up. Well, Marlon Gussman told us yesterday he made a trip every Tuesday bringing the most violent criminals when he was running the prison to Angola or to the state prisons. Of course, you have to let them know that you're coming. But as far as he indicated, and you can go back and listen to the interview at Odyssey, WWL.com and the Odyssey app, that these people should never have been at Parrish Prison or at the Orleans Justice Center for that long. They should have, one of them goes back to October, and a murder charge, I think, should have long time ago been transferred to the state. Well, I guess if the investigation continued plays out, 827 quickly traffic, WWL. All right, 8:45, quarter till 9. Let's lighten up a little bit here with the escape and everything else. Talk to Brian Kern, organizer of the Crew of Brew. Brian, how you doing?
Doing great. How are you today?
Brian, I don't know if you know this or not, but my late dad went to school with your late dad, and I went to school with your brother. I don't know if you know that or not. Small world, isn't it?
I did not know that. Yep. You went to Shaw, well, I take it.
And St. Julian, actually, before that.
Oh, yeah, okay, Algiers. Yep.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. So let's talk about
the obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
Tariffs and parades. Well, let me jump, first of all, you have a lot to do with, you know, promoting New Orleans and all the success that the city has had and everything. Are you hearing anything from people around the country about this jailbreak at all?
I hang out in the French Quarter. A lot of tourists are in town, and they've all heard about it. And mm-hmm. A lot of friends on the phone I've spoken to them lately that don't live here have all heard about it. Yeah, it's kind of embarrassing.
But, not anything that would have, yeah, I mean, it's embarrassing, but not to negatively affect the city from a business standpoint or anything, right? Yet?
No. I mean, not at all.
All right, that's good. Let's talk about tariffs and Mardi Gras throws or Crew of Boo throws and everything, and how much is purchased from China or how tariffs would affect all of this. You're the expert. Tell me.
Well, Crew of Boo, we've always, because we're a Halloween parade, we throw a lot of treats. And I've always, since year one, I resurrected the crew in 2013. And so this will be my 12th year stage in the parade. But I've always tried to buy as much local. I go local first, then I go state, and then I go country. Mm-hmm. And I try to refrain from Chinese items. However, I mean, plush, you know, which kids love, that comes from China. Nobody's making that here in the States. Light up beads, which I'm a night parade, so I want the light up beads. And then just regular beads. And I've been purchasing these items, but this year I'm being quoted a price, which is fine, but we just don't know with tariffs what the price is going to end up being when it lands. It could be, you know, twice as expensive. So I'm on the fence right now about whether or not I'll order the light up and the plush. But for the most part, I'm adding some new elements this year. I've got Jambalaya Girl. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She makes seasoning blends, and mm-hmm. she has a jambalaya mix. We'll be throwing that this year along with her gumbo. And we've been throwing for years since the
gumbo mix
came back.
Gumbo
Excuse
mixed.
Me?
Gumbo mix, to be clear.
Yeah, gumbo.
Not gumbo.
Yeah.
That'd be a mess.
Not hot
gumbo. No.
Yeah, it's hot gumbo and cauldrons on the crab.
That's not a good idea, no.
Aunt Sally's Promenettes, which are a great item, very expensive, made locally. Chattanooga Bakery, which manufactures the moon pies, those are a great item. And we added those probably 5 years ago. And people love the moon pies. They throw well. Ilmer's, our local brand of cheese curls, Chiwis, they're super popular. We throw a ton of those. We get our cups from Giacona Container Company, which is in Jefferson, Louisiana. Coffee, for years, PJ's was a sponsor, and I'm currently talking to another coffee company about coffee. But we throw 2.5-ounce frack packs of coffee, which go over real well. And then a few years ago, I added Just Born out of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, the Peeps, all the Halloween marshmallow candy, you know, like the, you know, Peeps for Easter. They have a whole Halloween line. And last year, Zapp's Potato Chips reached out to us about being part of the parade. They wanted to put their Zapp's fire truck in the parade. And so they're now one of our sponsors. And every rider gets like 100 bags of Zapp's to throw to people. And I would really love, I mean, I've reached out to them, but I love like Louisiana Fish Fry or one of the local producers of like a spice or a fish fry. I think that would be another great throw item, a nice bag with like 2 to 4 ounces of product in it. But for the most part, I mean, I think I'm probably going to end up, I'm looking at what stuff costs, and I can't figure it out because we don't know what the tariffs are going to do. I'm probably going to have to just up what I buy from the States this year, which, as far as I'm concerned, it's a good thing.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Meanwhile, you can ruminate on that idea of cauldrons of hot gumbo. I think it would go with the Halloween theme. Doesn't have to be boiling hot or anything. Just maybe tepid, all right? 8:50, 10 till 9, more with Brian Kern. We come back talking about having the throws made, and he said he starts with local and goes to state, then goes to country. And I want to talk more about Mardi Gras when we come back, too, because it seems as though there has been a move toward throws that people can actually use. But then you get to, like, if it's a brand name of something, does that have anything to do with the commercial products and if there's a way around that and so forth? 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:57, 3 till 9, Tommy Tucker back with Brian Kern, organizer of the Crew of Boo. Brian, you know, I knew your dad for a long time, and he would be proud, I think, of what you've done with the Crew of Boo because he was very passionate about it. He would come on with me at night, and I just want to tell you as a New Orleanian, I think you should take a lot of pride in the fact of what you've done with the company because I think you are a true visionary, as was your father, and you're looking ahead to years and years down the line. And I just want to tell you we're proud of you. So there you go.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. Thank you.
I mean that sincerely. Let's talk about throws because it seems as though I know Halloween is different because they're not bound by the commercial product rules that are Mardi Gras.
Right.
But it seems like the crews are getting the throws that are more usable and just, you know, you get the beads and then you turn them over to be recycled or whatever, as opposed to stuff you can use. Is there any way the city council would consider like a compromise between commercial support for Mardi Gras and just at least being able to throw products that people could use and want to eat? Because they do throw moon pies, don't they?
Moon pies get thrown. But my thoughts on it, I mean, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. I think anything made in New Orleans, if it's a brand that's made in our city, mm-hmm. I think you should be able to brand your item and throw it out as long as it's tastefully done. But like Bacchus or Endymion, one of the big super crews, they can afford because they're going to be throwing enough of the product to do custom film. But I still think the name of the company, if it's local, if it's made in Louisiana, should be on there. It should be able to promote it.
Going to what you said.
Better than buying all the, what's that?
going to what you said, like starting with local and then working out the state, it's better than you were getting ready to say it. Go ahead, say it.
Well, no, it's just we're throwing stuff that comes from China, and why wouldn't we want to support our local economy? This could be a booming business model for companies. You know, we'll throw your product, but it has to be manufactured in Orleans or Jefferson Parish. You know,
how do you
maybe
make that happen?
People would want to. Excuse me.
How you make that happen?
Well, if you have a product that wants to get into Mardi Gras, and you have, you know, 50,000 plus people throwing items, it could be a significant amount of money if it's the right product.
But I mean, politically, do you bring that before the council, Mardi Gras committee? What happens?
That's a good question. I'm sure the city council and the powers that be, the crews, would all have to agree on it.
You know what? We got to go here. But look.
Yes.
Just like your dad and my dad worked on something together, you and I could work on this together. Let's make that happen, all right? Stay in touch.
Sounds great.
You
all
bet.
Right, Tommy. Have a good
Barry
day.
Kern,
thank you.
Brian Kern, you too. Organizer of the Crew of Boo. We'll be back. And Christopher Gardner joins us now, professor of medicine and nutrition scientist at Stanford University. What we were just talking about with Mardi Gras probably makes as much sense to him as what we're going to talk about with oils makes to me right now. But we'll sort it out. How you doing, professor?
Hey, good morning from California. It's still early here, but how's Nola doing?
Good. We appreciate you getting up. Have you been to Mardi Gras or not?
Not to Mardi Gras, but there's a lot of conferences held in Nola. I go at least every other year for the last couple decades.
Thank you for doing that. We appreciate your business. Let's talk about this whole conversation with seed oils. I know you are a professor of medicine and nutrition, so maybe we can talk about, in general, what's good for you, what's bad for you. I know I've lost some weight as of late, and I've taken to reading packages, and my main thing is sugar and added sugar. The rest of it, I couldn't even begin to pronounce the stuff, let alone understand. So let's start there, Professor. Let's start with a doctor. Let's start with if we're going to try to evaluate what we eat, what's good, what's bad. How do you even go about that and understanding what's on the labels, what matters, what doesn't?
Yep, it's great. I'm glad you're reading labels. To be honest, the best food has no label. Bell peppers have no label. Broccoli has no label.
Oranges.
You know, if you were just going to buy some eggs, they don't. Well, I guess eggs probably have a label. But, a lot of this stuff.
Problem is getting the chicken to attach them. I'm sorry, doctor. I couldn't resist that.
Yeah.
With the eggs. That's my problem. But go ahead.
No worries. So this seed oil thing is really bizarre, Tommy. I'm happy to talk about it. Can we just start out?
And absolutely.
It shouldn't even be an issue. And this is probably my 25th interview on seed oils, which is pretty funny. Should we start and just describe
What is a seed oil? Because I don't know what that is.
Yeah, no problem. So you certainly have probably had sesame seed oil on some kind of dish. Olive oil is not a seed oil because they just squeeze the olives and it doesn't come out of the seed. It sort of comes out of the flesh of the olive. Mm-hmm. So there's a special set of the seed oils that for some reason has attracted attention. If any of your listeners are social media followers, a bunch of social influencers have called out the Hateful Eight. Okay, so maybe this is a step beyond where you want to go. But
no, I want to talk. We got an hour for this. I want people to understand. We try to educate. What we do, Doc, is more of a podcast than a traditional talk show because we like to go into detail on stuff and people to learn stuff. So let's start with the Hateful Eight.
Yeah, okay. So the Hateful Eight, the ones that you would recognize are corn oil, which is a little funny because corn technically isn't a seed. To be honest, corn could be a grain or a vegetable, or let's see, there's one other thing it can be, but it's actually not a seed. But a lot of people have probably bought corn oil at one point or another in their life, or seen sunflower or safflower oil on the shelf.
Are those the same or two different ones? Sunflower and safflower are different. Okay.
Yeah, those are different. So I'm sure people have seen a sunflower grow. I bet you they haven't seen a safflower. Some other ones would include rice bran oil, which is a little weird because rice isn't a seed, it's a grain. Mm-hmm. Another one is soybean oil, which also isn't a seed. Soybeans are beans. Mm-hmm. Another one is cottonseed oil. So you don't eat cotton. That one's a little weird, isn't it? Mm. So anyway, a lot of the food industry uses cottonseed oil. I'm trying to think, how many did I name already? I'm not sure if that's all.
Canola? Did you get to canola?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And canola is a really odd outlier, as you'll see in just a minute. Yes, canola oil is in there too, and there's a lot of
rapeseed, whatever
that
is.
There's a lot of. Yeah. Oh, good. Oh, you have the list in front of you. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me.
No,
yeah,
I just remembered. Doc, I don't have a list in front of me. I just remembered this. Come on.
This is awesome. Mm. Oh, Tommy, I'm totally impressed.
And
pulling all these off.
Grapeseed, which makes me wonder about grape nuts, because I never did quite understand what that is that you buy in a cereal box. Grapeseed, that's from the seeds of grapes?
Yeah, and it's not. That's funny that you're calling me out on that, because grapeseed I don't know that much about. But let's go back to canola, which is also called rapeseed oil.
Okay.
So sometimes people get grapeseed and rapeseed oil confused. And then just for fun for your listeners, because this might be a little fun fact, canola oil is the same as rapeseed oil. So if you look, sometimes you'll see these fields of yellow flowers. That's really the rapeseed. And historically, people found out you could get some oil out of the seeds from this thing, but it had something called erucic acid, which tasted horrible. And somebody figured out a way to make a GMO, a genetically modified organism, rapeseed oil that didn't have it. And it ends up being a prime oil out of Canada. And they were so proud of their genetically modified rapeseed oil that didn't have the erucic acid and didn't have the awful taste that they called it Canadian oil. Canadian oil with linoleic acid. And if you put that all together, it ended up being canola. But it's really just grapeseed
You have taught me some already. I always was under the impression, because for a while canola oil was being branded as a healthy way to eat, or something healthy, I guess. Now, I just presumed there was a canola plant. But I'll tell you this, from the marketing department, you definitely want to get away from rapeseed if you can, right?
No. So we'll get back to that. That's another sort of bizarre outlier in this whole Hateful Eight thing.
Okay.
So you between the two of us, we just named the eight.
Mm-hmm.
And a bizarre thing, since we have the 40 minutes or hour that you just said, let's just start at the one bizarre place for me, which is, of the Hateful Eight, three of them aren't seeds.
Right.
So then there's some confusion in going from seed oils.
Corn,
to the
rice,
Hateful Eight.
And soy.
And two,
right? Corn, rice,
two
and soy
of the,
are not seeds.
Yeah, right. Okay. And then you are really following along. I'm totally impressed here.
I pay attention.
Think about sesame seed and flaxseed oil. So flax is a really hot item these days in the world of nutrition, partly because of omega-3 fats, which I'm going to get to again in a minute, unless I blow everybody's heads up. So two seed oils that aren't in the Hateful Eight, which is mostly seed oils, are sesame seed and flaxseed. So for some reason, nobody ever gives them a hard time. Everybody thinks, oh my God, the sesame seed oil, even toasted sesame seed oil, is used pretty often in healthy foods, and flaxseed oil. So, Tommy, one of the things I want to focus on for our hour today is, do you have this at home and do you cook with it, versus is this in industrially processed crappy foods that Americans buy a lot of? Because that's an important differentiator here.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some restaurants say that they're going seed oil free. And so restaurants, you know, make fine food. There's restaurants and they cook with oils and they have them there. And then there's fast food restaurants that deep fry French fries. And that's a little different than restaurants that are cooking from scratch. So if you don't mind, those are all the things that we have to unpack. Seed oils, the Hateful Eight, cooking at home, cooking at restaurants, deep frying French fries, and a lot of the ultra-processed food out there that's crap. So
let me throw something else in the suitcase if I can, and that is when we hear about Wesson or whatever, or vegetable oil, that's different and distinct, or is that one of what we already mentioned?
No, that's in there. So those are often blends of oils. It might be a soybean and a corn oil.
Okay.
So picture this. Fat tastes good, and fat feels good in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So when people are making ultra-processed foods for us that are out there on the market that are inexpensive and convenient and sort of readily available for somebody on a budget. A lot of them have these Hateful Eight seed oils in them. And that's probably the biggest problem. If we want to start with the problem is those foods that contain them. But Tommy, here's the big problem. Most of those foods are crap anyway. And so let's say you found some crappy cupcake, cookie, chip, candy, dessert, something that you weren't picking because it was a health food. You were picking because it was a treat. And you found out there was seed oil in it, and you were gassed, and you just closed your eyes and put your hands on your head and couldn't believe it had seed oil. And some food industry folks said, we realize you hate seed oils. We're going to take them out. We're going to put something else in instead. The thing they put in instead wouldn't probably make it a health food. And the choices here could be olive or avocado. Those seem to have a huge health halo over them, the olive oil and the avocado oil, but they're expensive. Mm-hmm. If you put those in, those foods are going to be a lot more expensive. Or coconut. Coconut oil tends to fall in the category of saturated fat, which we'll get back into right now by saying the other options are to put in butter or lard or beef tallow. Mm-hmm. And a fascinating thing with this Hateful Eight seed oil is there's a lot of folks who are using this, or a lot of these are the same folks who think saturated fat got a bad rap here. Saturated fat isn't that bad for you. And let's be super specific. So there's a fast food place called Steak Shack. And Steak Shack proudly announced about a month ago that it was sick and tired of deep frying its French fries in seed oil, and it was going to go back to deep frying them in beef tallow, which is how part of the reason McDonald's fries got famous decades and decades ago. They were deep frying their potato fries in beef tallow. And a big concern came up about the saturated fat in diets being bad for us. They said, oh, my God, we're actually now going to stop deep frying our French fries in beef tallow, and we're going to switch to vegetable oil.
So now you're saying, and we got to take a break here, but now you're saying that they're going back to beef tallow, which is what they got away from originally under the auspices of getting away from seed oil?
From getting away from saturated fat.
Saturated fat.
Yeah. Yes. No. You're right. No, the beef tallow is saturated fat. They were trying to get away from the last two decades of deep frying in seed oil. And let's leave your listeners hanging there and we'll come back.
Hi, it sounds great to me. We're talking about seed oil and a Hateful Eight and what's good for you and what's bad for you. Christopher Gardner's a guest professor of medicine, nutrition scientist at Stanford University. You got any questions? 504-260-1870. That's the Oquinar Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Do not ever text and drive. Please, and we're going to talk about ultra-processed foods as well and what that is. Somebody texted in about that. I know we've had experts on already that talked about the way they manipulate ultra-processed foods with mouthfeel and texture and these different things to make you crave them and make you want them, even though the last thing in the world it is healthy for you. Back in a flash, WWL. Talking to Dr. Christopher Gardner, professor of medicine, nutrition scientist at Stanford University. Doctor, let me just recap this real quick. So McDonald's was frying their fries in beef tallow. In the 90s, they had some pushback because they were saying this is not the healthiest thing in the world. So they went to a different kind of oil, a vegetable oil, a seed oil, if you will. So now RFK gets the internet going with seed oils are dangerous, the Hateful Eight, as you say. So Steak Shack says, guess what? We're going to make America healthy again. We're going to start frying our fries in beef tallow, which is what McDonald's originally got away from. Is that accurate?
That is good. And this is a great way to sort of wrap up this chapter and move on to the next part of the story. But I got to tell you, I am not going to die on this hill of French fries.
No.
So this... Yeah. The idea that we're suddenly going to make French fries healthy and a health food by not deep frying them in one oil and deep frying them in another is a little bit absurd.
Well, let me just add in, too. When you talk about sugar, if you think going to Steak and Shake or whatever the name of the place is, if you're going to get healthy food there, you're kidding yourself. Come on, Doc, right? Wake up.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's a little funny that this has become such a sort of badge of honor to say you're going to do this. And part of this is, think of what this is. So when you're frying fries in a fast food restaurant, one of the issues is you're using that oil all day long. You've filled up the deep fat fryer. You're not frying one thing of French fries and then dumping it out and refilling it with a new fresh one. You're just frying it again and again and again and again and again in that oil. And that should never be the starting point of a healthy diet, French fries. So let's set that one aside. But it is funny that people are doing that. Oh, wait, I forgot one other fun fact. So it's actually, they got outed for seeing that their supplier of the French fry pre-fries them in vegetable and seed oils and then sends them to Steak Shack. And then they re-deep fry them in beef tallow before they hand them out to their customers. So they're pretty proud of their beef tallow, but they're not saying they're actually still pre-fried in vegetable and seed oils. But I don't, let's not get stuck in that rabbit hole.
Yeah, but again, the operative words here are deep fried, don't you think?
Yeah. Thank you. And like if you go to Iowa, you can get deep fried butter stick at the fair.
Sure.
And I don't think deep frying butter in seed oils or beef tallow will matter.
It'll make a big difference, no.
Stick of butter. Okay.
So go ahead.
So let's move on to the next thing in this whole story, Tommy. And that is omega-3 versus omega-6. And that is, I think people are using the word seed oils because they figure some heads will blow up if you get into omega-6 and omega-3s. Mm-hmm. But I do think that's the heart of the matter. And the word that comes up is inflammation.
Okay.
So in the world of health these days, inflammation is a pretty hot topic. Inflammatory. I know we have inflammatory words, but there's actually inflammatory processes that happen in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And something to remember up front is that while inflammation sounds like something you don't want to have around for a long time, the inflammatory response that your body has to some kind of injury is actually part of your whole health system. If you have something dangerous in you, if you cut yourself and have a wound, you actually have this very beneficial inflammatory response. In the world of medicine, there's a whole inflammatory cascade of molecules that get released that race to the site of injury, and your body's going to look red and it's going to be painful for a while until it heals. Like that inflammatory process is really important for you to heal when it's an acute situation, when it's happened right away.
Akin to akin to the warning light on your dashboard when you turn the key on?
Yeah, okay. Something like that.
Right.
So, and when you have a fever, I mean, nobody likes to have a fever. Do you know what a fever is doing? It's killing you, raises your body temperature to kill off stuff that's hurting you. And in the long run, you'll recover and you'll live because of your inflammatory response. So chronic inflammation, if people are chronically have this modestly elevated level of inflammation in their body, that's not good for you. But there is a place for inflammation being healthy in your body. And like a lot of other things, Tommy, it's a balance. I'm going to bring up blood sugar just for a minute here because I think it's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you and most of your listeners will recognize that there's two bad conditions for blood sugar. One is your blood sugar being too high and one is being too low. Your body spends a whole lot of time making sure your blood sugar is in the middle, not too high and not too low. And that's where inflammation should be. It should be ready to respond and not too high, but not too low, because that could also be bad for you. And so some of these fats that we eat have a role in inflammation. And for the most part, the fat we eat, Tommy, is just for energy. Almost all the fat we eat just is like fuel in our body. Glucose and sugars and fats are mostly just fuel. But there's a couple of the fats that we eat, and among them are these seed oils, where a small portion of them can be used to regulate part of our metabolism. And so two of these families are called omega-6s and omega-3s. And anybody who's into nutrition has probably heard both of those terms. I'm sure you have, right?
I have, yeah.
Do Do you have any preconceived notion about what is good or bad or omega-6?
You know, I think I thought one of them might be good, one of them might be bad, but I couldn't, I don't know.
Yeah, so, and first of all, let me tell you, let me describe what they are.
Okay.
So all fats are long chains of carbons, one after the other. And some of the butter fats are only 4 carbons, and some of the fish fats are 26 carbons. Mm-hmm. And the way your body works for energy is it takes however many carbons it has and it breaks off pairs of them 2 at a time, and it generates, if you remember from high school, ATP, this energy unit that you use to fuel everything in your body. And it starts with 2 carbons at a time from fat or 2 carbons at a time from sugar. So anyway, we have these fats in our diet that go into our mouth and we digest and absorb them. And they're either 4 carbons or anything up to 26 carbons. Most of them happen to be 16 or 18 carbons long. Mm-hmm. That's the most common type of fat we eat. And 2 of the particular ones that we eat, and you just stop me if I go too far down the rabbit hole, are linoleic and linolenic acid. And they only differ by 1 letter. Both of them have 18 carbons. Both of them have more than 1 double bond in them, and double bond means that they're unsaturated fats, which most people have heard of. And a fun thing about unsaturated fat versus saturated fat is when these long chains of carbons have a double bond in them, it makes them bend. If they don't have a double bond, they're absolutely straight and they're saturated. And when they're straight and saturated, they can actually line up one on top of the other in such a way that they're solid at room temperature. Butter, mm-hmm. solid at room temperature. Beef tallow, solid at room temperature. Lard, solid at room temperature. So is coconut oil. And palm oil, those tropical plant oils, are also mostly saturated and solid at room temperature. But the reason these other things we're talking about, seed oils, are oils and liquid at room temperature, is that these are fats that have double bonds. They're unsaturated. They bend. These carbon chains bend. And because they're bent, they don't line up right on top of each other. And their melting point is different. And so you can pour them into your salad dressing. You can pour them into your pan to saute something or stir fry something. They are oil. They are liquid at room temperatures. And all restaurants have them. I'm pretty sure all your listeners have some kind of cooking oil mm-hmm. at home. And so these omega-6s and omega-3s are pretty fun because they help regulate metabolism. And this is really way too much to get into for the show, but there's these long pathways where when your body is ready and needs them and calls on them for metabolism, they go through these changes. And after going through these changes, the omega-6s, whose last double bond in the chain of carbons is 6 back from the end, and the omega-3s, the last double bond, is 3 carbons back from the end. That's how they get their name. The omega-6s and omega-3s are both long chains of carbon with more than 1 double bond, and the reason they have their name is the position of one of their double bonds at the end. And while that's more than you and your listeners need to know, the kind of cool thing is if you need to use one of these fats for metabolism and you happen to have an omega-3 on hand, it's a little more leaning toward vasodilation than vasoconstriction. And that just means your blood vessels are narrowing or widening. So omega-3s tend to be sort of vasodilating or blood thinning. And so some people take omega-3 fats or fish oil fats because they have heart disease and they want their arteries in their veins to be more open than closed. To be honest, those omega-3 fish oil pills don't work very much, according to science. But there's a plausible mechanism where that works. And the omega-3s are pretty good at lowering triglycerides. And the omega-3s have a couple of factors that make them sort of more cool than omega-6s in many situations. But here's where the social influencers are getting it wrong, Tommy, mm-hmm. is because you can use an omega-6 or omega-3 for the same thing, and because omega-3s are a little bit cooler than omega-6s in many of these aspects, somebody flipped it to say, oh my God, the omega-6s are killing you. They are pro-inflammatory. They're pro-blood coagulant. They're raising your blood pressure. They're doing all the opposites of omega-3s. And that part's wrong.
We got to take a break here, Doctor. We'll pick it up when we come back. But let me tell you something. I mean this with all due respect.
Okay.
I wanted you to go down that rabbit hole. I wanted you to glaze our eyes over because... let me explain why. And I mean this with all due respect.
Okay.
Because I want people to realize that what you just explained is just a superficial explanation of the way it works. So to think that you can go onto a Facebook post or read something from a social media influencer and think that you understand it, you understand the point I'm trying to make?
Thank you. I totally appreciate that, and I feel respected.
It sincerely, yeah. We'll take a break, pick it up, we come back. One other thing I want to talk about before we do run out of time is, since you mentioned sugar, it just seems like, you know, we talk about seed oil or we talk about vaccines or whatever it is. Meanwhile, sugar is destroying lives in this country and killing people left and right, and nobody says anything about that at all. We'll take a break, pick it up, we come back. WWL Traffic now. 9:50, 10 till 10. Doc, we only got about 2 minutes left. Christopher Gardner, professor of medicine, nutrition scientist at Stanford University, trying to debunk these myths about the Hateful Eight when it comes to vegetable oil. And if you missed any of it, you can download the Odyssey app or go to WWL.com, click on my name, you'll find the audio posted. I do want to spend a minute or two, and you can come back and talk about seed oil some more. We'd love to have you. But about sugar, and you know, I had a professor of biology at where I graduated from college, UNO, years ago, try to explain why, if you wanted to lose weight, you really had to cut sugar out of your diet, and I didn't understand it. Now I do. Explain, if you will, for a minute about the dangers of sugar and processed food and what people need to look for and how almost impossible it is to take in too much sugar and lose weight.
Yeah, so great way to wrap up is, seed oils pale completely in comparison to so much sugar. Like 20 different names for sugar. Everybody likes sugar. It tastes good. The food industry is putting it in everything that we're eating. It isn't satiating. So when you have it, you get calories, but you're not full, and you still want more calories. Mm-hmm. So that's a big, much bigger issue than seed oils, Tommy. You're right. So you got to look for it. It's got a lot of different names, but look at that nutrition fact panel, which got updated recently on packaged foods, and it not only tells you how much sugar, but how much added sugar. So look at that added sugar line, because fruit sugar is okay. Added sugar is not. Can we do seed oils for another minute?
Sure.
Okay, so let's wrap this up at the end of the day. If you go back 50, 60, 70 years, there's all kinds of studies that were done, mostly about LDL cholesterol for heart disease, showing that anytime you swap out butter, beef tallow, or lard for any seed oil, sesame seed, corn seed, rape seed, it always lowers your LDL cholesterol. So the American Heart published something in 2009 and again in 2017. So if you look at all the data, switching out those saturated fats, those animal fats, for any kind of seed oil, omega-6 or omega-3 is better for you. The science is there all over the place. But really, let's bring it back to what people are eating. When they're eating ultra-processed, crappy foods in the store that's junk food, there's seed oils in them. If you want to now avoid those because of the seed oils, great. That'll help you because it had a lot of sugar in it too. But we told you it had sugar before and you're still eating it. I don't know that seed oils is going to have you stop eating it. What I don't want you to do, Tommy, I don't want you to stop having salads where you made a salad dressing that had sunflower or safflower oil in it because it was less expensive than olive oil. I don't want you to stop having a healthy stir fry that you made at home and you cooked it in a vegetable oil because it was less expensive. I don't want you to swap out and now cook with butter and lard and beef tallow because of this big debate. If you wanted to switch that seed oil out for avocado or olive oil, I'm all in. That's probably a little bit better for you, but more important than the oil that you're using to cook with is what you're cooking. Are you cooking vegetables? Are you cooking a stir fry? Are you making a salad? Those are all great for you, but if you're using it at home to deep fry crap in it. So it's a lot of what you eat it with, and mostly what we're eating. We're not drinking the oil, Tommy. I hope we're cooking stuff with it. So pay attention to what you're cooking with it.
Doctor, I hope you come back. I really honestly do, because, you know, it's all about science and the truth and not just jumping to a silly conclusion. How long did you go to school, Doc? Just out of curiosity.
Four or five years of doctorate work and all that college. Yeah.
So you're right. So years and years and years. You didn't just get it from the internet in 5 seconds, did you? Thank you, Christopher Gardner.
No.
And why would you have a salad when you can have some healthy fries from Steak and Shake? Christopher Gardner, professor of medicine and nutrition scientist at Stanford University. We got to go. You can come back. Newell's next. We'll see what he's got coming up when we return.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Friedman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, we got to run a business and we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because I think most of us, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.